Welcome to episode 384 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. On this week's episode, we feature a wonderful conversation with the intellectual affairs columnist for Inside Higher Education, Scott McLemay. We discuss how he got to do what he does indeed do, and how using your own perspective is a good technique. We discuss Shakespeare and Trump and Steve Bannon, as well as Lenin and Trotsky and Stalin. Being a perpetual student, and reflect a bit on the pandemic and remote education. A really great conversation with Scott McLemay. We also feature an EW essay titled Charlie, and episode 3 of a radio play written by our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, titled The Lonesome Cowboy, as performed by Dominic Azzarelli. And we have a poem called Trusty Couch. And of course, all of this will be imbued, infused with the wonderful energy of several great tunes. It is so nice to have you with us. Let's get to it. Episode 384 of Troubadours and Raconteurs.
Picture yourself in a living room, your pipe and slippers set out for you. I know you think that it ain't too far, but I hear a call of a lifetime ring. Felt the need to get up for it. Oh, and cut out the middleman, get free from the middleman. You got no time for the messenger, got no regard for the thing that you don't understand. You got no fear of the underdog, that's why you will not survive. I wanna forget how convention fits, but can I get out from under it? Can I cut it out of me? Oh, it can't all be wedding cake, it can't all be boiled away. I try but I can't let go of it, can't let go of it. Cause you don't talk to the water boy, and there's so much you could learn, but you don't wanna know. You will not back up an inch ever, that's why you will not survive. I tell you now, it may not go over well. Oh, and it may not be for a while. No way that I spell it out. But you won't hear from the messenger. Don't wanna know about something that you don't understand. You got no fear of the underdog, that's why you will not survive. Right! We'll be right back.
Charlie, what is the point of all this? I asked the woman who married me, despite warnings from some of my dearest friends and her mother. We were walking together up a paved hillside street in the breeze off the trees of the West Mountain Range. A little girl, I would estimate at 4 years of age, was standing with her wind-blown, knotted long, light brown hair partially covering her face. She held her small hands together with fingers partially interlocked. A pair of summer flip-flops on her feet as the cuffs of long, baggy faded blue jeans set atop of little toes. Her left foot just touching the granite, shale, gray, shaggy fur of a handsome, square-faced mutt, sitting with all four legs and belly on the grass of a side yard that abuts the street we walked. Looking happy, poised, earnest, and proud, the young one waved and said hello. The dog let out a small bark. As we walked, I asked if it is a boy or a girl. She said, "It's a boy." "What's his name?" "Charlie." My wife and I waved and said, "See you later." The little girl waved too, smiling and happy, standing there. Her mom watching from the backyard as she rearranged some lawn chairs. My wife said as we walked up the hill, "That's the point of all this."
In this time that I've been given to fill my life with living, I hope I've done the best that I can do. Yes, regrets I've got a few, but honey, none of them is you, and I need you like a singer needs a song. I don't know if heaven's real, but that's how you make me feel. You make it all right when everything's wrong. And this is our song. Made me feel. you make it all right when everything's wrong. And this is our song. And this is our song. This is our song. This is our song.
Hello?
Hello, Scott McLemy, is that you?
Is this Dr. Demure? Do you go by that, or is it Conundrum Demure? Or?
You could call me whatever you like, you know, EW. Yeah, whatever works for you. It works for me.
I'm warning you, we're having some repairs done today, and so I have cats in my office. So if there's any crashing or noises like that, that's what that is. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Scott McLemy is the intellectual affairs columnist for Inside Higher Ed. As such, he writes a weekly column. His essays, reviews, and interviews have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Globe, The Nation, Newsday, Book Forum, International Socialist Review, and numerous other publications. He was a contributing editor for Lingua Franca magazine from 1995 until 2001. And covered scholarship in the humanities as senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education between 2001 and 2005. He has served on the board of directors of the National Book Critics Circle, and in 2004 received the NBCC's Award for Excellence in Reviewing. Troubadours and Rock on Tours is happy to have on the program Scott McLemy. Thank you, sir, again for being on the program, and just want to jump right in. Give the folks, if you would, listening, a little sort of background on exactly what you do as the intellectual affairs columnist.
Sure, sure. Well, I mean, just for background, I'm from my family background is from Texas, and I think in a way, once you're from Texas, you're sort of always from Texas. But I live in Washington, D.C. now, and I used to work at the Library of Congress in the manuscript division there before, while I was sort of getting started publishing. So that goes to the degree of, you know, of interest in like history and just having access to a library. Unfortunately, I met and married a reference librarian while I was there, which, if you know, if you're a writer, that's just absolutely the smartest thing you could ever do. my interests in my background are in various figures, including Kenneth Burke, who's a great literary theorist and commentator, and C.L.R. James, who wrote the history of the Haitian slave revolution called the Black Jacobins. And so all of these are things that I've come back to in my own work. But in doing the column, it's a matter of always trying to sort of keep my attention open to both what's happening in the news now and what is coming from the publishers that looks like it might be of general interest, or might be at least sort of worth poking around with and seeing if there's any connection with things that are of general concern. So I write this column. It used to be weekly, and since earlier this year, it's twice a month, in which I go through usually a new university press or scholarly books and write about them with a degree of a personal voice, I guess. I don't want the column to be about me, but I'm also completely willing and able to use my own perspective in approaching books. So I don't know if that's enough of a framing of what I do, but that's what I aspire to anyway.
Well, yeah, it's great. And I'm just wondering, you know, the audience, is it a specialized audience, would you say, that would read your work? And, you know, is it, what's the intent? Is it to get a better handle on what exactly?
Well, the audience of for Inside Higher Ed and the audience for a number of the places that I've written for, the Lingua Franca and the Chronicle of Higher Education and so on, is includes, you know, people who are definitely are specialists in the subjects that I'm writing about, which certainly is a terror sometimes. But I must generally do things right because I don't get called out all that much. But Inside Higher Ed has an audience of, I don't know, like a couple of million people in all different levels of higher education, from, you know, graduate students to administrators to professors to everybody, human resource people and so forth. So I've always got the possibility of somebody who both knows absolutely nothing about what I'm writing about reading it, and somebody who knows far more than I or even maybe the author of the book I'm writing about now. So that's a little bit, you know, that's like juggling chainsaws or something. But that's the audience I'm going for, the famed common reader or a general educated public, which is a somewhat mythological notion at this point in history, but it is what I try to write for.
Yeah, yeah, and as you said, it must be somewhat of a terror, given you have all of these really bright people who probably have some egos going along with that intelligence that, you know, you have to wonder if they're going to pounce, saying,
Oh, yeah.
But it doesn't happen often, it seems. You're highly regarded.
Not really. I mean, occasionally, you know, you have to cut corners sometimes and you don't, like, give all of the background on a given subject. And somebody will say, aha, well, you didn't know this. And I was like, yes, I did know it, but I don't have, you know, a book. I'm not writing a book here. I'm writing a thousand to 1,500 word column most of the time.
So it's limited.
It's a skill set. It's absolutely a skill set, and it is, frankly, one that academics are not generally encouraged to cultivate. I mean, you get sort of, you know, paid by the pound with academic prose. And if you're writing for the kinds of newspapers and magazines I started out in, you know, the ability to say something in 500 words or 1,000 words is a skill that's cultivated. And on a publication that I do some editorial work for, somebody said, well, I can't write about a subject in under 10,000 words.
Huh.
And I thought, I didn't say, but I thought, if you can't say something in under 10,000 words, then you don't have anything to say.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I think this is Einstein, and I'm paraphrasing, but basically at one point he shared the notion that someone who really knows something doesn't need a lot of words and can clearly explain what they know with a limited amount of words and put it in a way that is very accessible.
Well, and in that regard, I'll say that one of my models, maybe my greatest of household gods, is the English essayist William Hazlitt from the early 19th century, who has an essay called On Familiar Style. And he says, to write a genuine, familiar, or truly English style is to write as anyone would speak in common conversation who had a thorough command and choice of words, or who could discourse with force, ease, and perspicuity, setting aside all pedantic and oratorical flourishes. It is easy to affect a pompous style, to use a word twice as big as the thing you want to express. It is not so easy to pitch upon the very word that exactly fits it. So that, you know, that's something to measure your effort by, and that he pretty much hit the target on that.
Oh yeah, that makes total sense. And you know, some of the areas that you do delve into via your column. What would be some? Give us some examples of some of the focus that you've had.
Sure. Well, going back to just through the summer, and you know, given the world circumstances, it's really hard to find things that are not overwhelmingly connected with the news, or at the same time not going to be of any interest to anybody because the news is so pressing. But I, for example, the column that I have today is on a little book by Bernard-Henri Lévy, the French self-described philosopher. I'm a little dubious about that, But he has a little book about the coronavirus, which he wrote and finished in June. It was published by Yale University Press last month, and I'm reviewing it now, and it's really, really not very good, but it is interesting, and it's badness. that's kind of nice when that happens. But earlier in the summer, I think back in May, I did a review of a book by Jeffrey R. Wilson called Shakespeare and Trump. More recently, I did one on by a couple of French authors called How Everything Can Collapse. That gives you some sense of how I'm trying to, both address what's in the news and get books that do things that aren't just about today's breaking events.
When you mentioned
I read a little bit of what I wrote in approaching the Shakespeare and Trump book, because I have to admit I was totally dubious about this book.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask you. You're reading my mind.
Well, I thought it was a preposterous idea. I hate to admit it. I mean, you have to. One thing I do is I work with my prejudices or my assumptions. I'm willing to confront them, and use that as material, even in framing what I got to say about a book. And so I said in the opening to the piece, I wrote, the prospect of reading a book about Donald Trump and William Shakespeare initially struck me as dubious on what seemed like obvious grounds. Trump is manifestly un-Shakespearean. He is fond of monologues, to be sure, but they reveal nothing. His character is too thin, his motives too blatant. Trump's lies are uninspired and self-defeating, not through adverse consequences, but simply from the sheer volume and transparency of them. His failures do not elicit pathos, resolving themselves time and again into bankruptcy of the most literal sort, with no less lasting consequences, at least for him. He is often incoherent, but never enigmatic. Nothing could make Trump a tragic figure, and Shakespeare has clowns of greater moral complexity. So that was my initial, that was my feeling going into reading the book. And I read the book, and I won't say that I was wrong about Trump, but I was wrong about the book. Because this author, Jeffrey R. Wilson, has went through and showed, for example, in 2016, half the pundits and half the journalists who wrote anything about Shakespeare, it seems like, you referred to Shakespeare at some point along the way. Steve Bannon, currently, incarcerated, I guess.
Right.
Steve Bannon, in the 1990s, worked on, he was a movie producer, and he had in production two movies based on adaptations of Shakespeare's plays, Titus Andronicus, which is a crazy, weird play, and Coriolanus, reimagined respectively as a science fiction adventure in outer space and a hip-hop musical set in South Central Los Angeles. Now, that's both a sort of an interesting tidbit, but when you get in and you actually look at this author did, he went and he got a hold of copies of the scripts and he analyzed them, and found that you can find an awful lot of Steve Bannon's politics, and consequently, of course, Trump's politics, in these plays, these screenplays, which sound absolutely terrible. One of the lines from one of the films says, he climbs onto her and their forms dissolve, blend and blur in an erotic scene of ectoplasmic sex.
That's lame.
So it's probably best that movie was not made, but you know.
I'm sorry, that's just hilariously bad.
So, or maybe it will be now. Who knows? It might find an audience now. But also, back in 2017, and this shows you how much you forget these things. This was big news at the time, and I forgot about it entirely. There was a production of Julius Caesar in Central Park, in which the Julius Caesar character was blatantly modeled on Donald Trump. He had the hair, he had the red tie, the whole bit.
I remember. So I remember that.
The assassination scene naturally drove some people into an absolute frenzy, right, as you'd expect. It was one of those, it was the scandal of the day, I guess. And so as I write here and commenting on that, I said, furious commentators demanded to know what would have happened if it were Barack Obama who had been the one assassinated on stage. The elites never would have allowed that. Well, in fact, they did. A production of Julius Caesar in Minneapolis 5 years earlier had a tall, charismatic, confident basketball-playing Obama Caesar who was stabbed by right-wing conspirators. And that was not, you know, that was not such a big deal, but with Trump it was. So it was just the book won me over, and I really hope that, you know, it finds readers beyond, you know, the students who will be assigned it to read, and I think the students who will be assigned it to read will get a lot out of it.
And the title of it again is Shakespeare and Trump?
That's right, Shakespeare and Trump, and, you know, I don't remember which press published it. I can look it up here. But, yeah, it's Temple University Press.
And the author again?
So
I think you mentioned the author, but I didn't catch it. Do you have his name handy?
What's that?
The author. Do you have his name handy?
The author's name is Jeffrey R. Wilson.
Jeffrey O. Wilson. Thank you. You have to look
that
up.
Yeah, it is. I usually say where somebody teaches, but I don't have that right at hand.
Well, so when you're looking, this is all about, I guess, these efforts, the Chronicle and the other periodicals that you write for. The reason we put this out is so that these thoughts, these ideas, these reviews, is so that we're better informed and we're better thinkers. So we have a sense of history and we have some healthy discourse, debate, arguments about what are good ideas and what are bad ideas, to put it simply. I mean,
absolutely.
That's basically what you're doing with your skill set, with your intelligence.
It's what I'm trying to do, and without being too pompous or pretentious about it, it does sort of fall under the general heading of continuing education. It's certainly continuing education for my part, because I have basically a job in which I am a perpetual student. Right. I mean, I'm always, you know, reading books on subjects that, and some things I know a lot about and some things I don't know anything about. So it's you know, a continuing education for me. But also, to do my job at all well, I have to make it the material available to people who, you know, as we've already said, had various levels of exposure to the subjects. And so, you know, I hope it has to some degree that effect. You can't really quantify that sort of thing, but that's what I'm after.
Now, I know you're not an expert in pedagogy, and you don't claim to be. But given, you know, what we're all facing at this point in time, with regard to having to do most of our educating or discussions remotely, our connection remotely because of the pandemic. Does that bode well for the experience of growing as a thinker, of learning, of connecting, do you think?
You know, I think about that all the time, and I don't know. I mean, I have to say that you hope so, and we'd better, you know, it had better work that way, because it really does seem like we're kind of going to be stuck in this mode for a while. But there's just a lot of stuff that goes on just at the, you know, the talking after class type of thing, you know, where, you know, you stand around, and if a professor is a particularly good lecturer, you know, you go up to him or her and ask questions that you were maybe too embarrassed to raise in class or whatever, that sort of thing. And that, I just don't know how much of that's going to be possible.
Yeah,
I mean, maybe it is. Maybe, you know, you send somebody an email and get the same sort of interaction. But I'm maybe old school enough to think that the face to face is part of it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I'm with you. And it could just be because we're of a different generation and we're, you know, old and in the way. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm an educator, and I've been forced to go online because of the pandemic. And you know, you find ways, you make adjustments. The connections aren't the same, generally speaking, you know, not just with regard to education, as, you know, they would be if you were able to be in physical contact with other humans. But you still can have some sort of significant connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, I spend, like a lot of people do now, an awful lot of time on conference calls and things like that. And I saw somewhere the other day somebody said that a memoir of this period would be called In the Zoom Where It Happened. And that's certainly it. And you do sort of, you know, that can be exhausting in its own way after a while. But it's what we've got, and it is remarkable that we have it.
Yeah, otherwise, I think our situation would be even more dire, right? I mean, we'd be just stuck with the people. Not to say it's a bad thing. I don't want to offend anybody from my family who's listening, but we'd or yours, we'd be just stuck with those people in the house that we're quarantined with or sequestered with, and no one else.
You're listening to Troubadours and Rock on Tours with E.W. Conundrum Demure on WFTE Radio, Mount Cobb and Scranton, Pennsylvania. Community radio at its finest.
Absolutely. My wife is a big theater buff, which is partly why I'm as interested in Shakespeare as I've gotten, because I've seen a lot of Shakespeare now under her tutelage. And we were talking the other day, and I said, you know, I'm having bookstore dreams. Now, I don't need any more books. So I have, like, you know, walls of books here. But it's one of the pleasures of life for me to go into a bookstore and see what's new.
Yeah.
You know? And she said, oh, I have theater dreams. And I thought, well, of course you do. You know, it never occurred to me that she did, but of course she did. She's gone to theater every week for, you know, her entire adult life, and you can't do that now. You can take classes on theater. You can watch theater performances, you know, that are broadcast. But you know, there's something about live theater which at its very best is absolutely transformative.
Yes.
Well, on our honeymoon, we saw an astounding production of Medea, Euripides' Medea in London, and which was done almost as a ritual, almost as a kind of a, you know, a Greek mystery religion ritual, and it was just easily one of the most astounding, you know, experiences in ever going to theater, and it just would not be the same if it were done on a big screen.
No, or a little screen, you know, on your laptop, which, you know, but, you know, I wanted to broaden it, this discussion, outside of the context of the pandemic, when you look at how we in these United States in particular, I guess, connect with the human experience via history, via the arts. And you know, what is easily accessible in our culture day to day? Do you think the experience is one that can cultivate a well-rounded, thoughtful individual, or do you think it's not so accessible and somewhat limited to be able to develop as a person in that way?
I think it's. It would really be risky to try to answer that, because you can't or shouldn't anyway underestimate people's capacity to do remarkable things with the hand they've been dealt. And so, with that in mind, you know, I think that the fact that we are so incredibly hooked up and connected and, you know, able to communicate. Now, on the one hand, obviously it has some bad effects, and I'll just say the word QAnon and leave it at that. But it also has the potential for positive things, and I just you know, I think we're going to see a mixture of both in the months ahead.
Well, maybe I'm romanticizing, and I probably am. I'm going off a mythology in my head, but now being overwhelmed with so much, oftentimes, you know, I see people choosing things like TikTok, you know, over sitting on the back porch and just reading a book because you have no other alternative.
Right.
You know, and I wonder if all the access to all of these possible ways of stimulating your mind doesn't lead us to the right choices.
Well, and that is as some people have pointed out, is almost by design, because the whole way that these a lot of these things are set up, social media platforms and whatnot, are to give you that little surge of dopamine when you have, you know, somebody who liked your comment or whatever, and that is in itself quite addictive. You know, dopamine is what makes methamphetamine so apparently so very, very enjoyable. And so that's just not good. And I think that if there's going to be any good that comes out of all this, it will be from people sort of reaching the point where they can use these capacities, these tools and whatnot, but also grasp the need to limit their use of them. That's maybe a little too optimistic, but I do think that it's certainly what I'm struggling to try to do.
Yeah, and I appreciate it. I appreciate that. Appreciate your part in it. Scott McLemy, we're talking with today, and he spends a lot of time reviewing and writing about education and various aspects and pursuits in that realm, particularly through the Inside Higher Ed periodical, Education, and we're trying to understand basically where we're going from here as a culture in the United States. I'm focusing on the United States only. That's enough to try to figure out. What are you working on at present? You have any upcoming projects that are of interest?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier, I am something of a scholar of C.L.R. James, who was lived between 1901 and 1989. He was from Trinidad and lived in England for much of his life, and also in the United States for a long period. He went to Mexico to talk to Trotsky. Any number of his students and admirers went on to run, you know, various countries in the what was called the Third World. And he wrote what is still, I think, pretty much considered the great work of history and English language about the Haitian Revolution, called The Black Jacobins. But he also wrote a book about Melville, and his associates were the first to translate Karl Marx's 1844 economic and philosophical manuscripts. Just a fascinating fellow, character, and somebody whose work I've been reading and studying for a good 30-something years now. I've edited two books of his writings in quite some time ago, and I now have two other volumes of his work that I'm working on. And I'm also supposed to be putting together a book of my own essays, but I keep finding ways to put that off. So I think that's one of the things I want to try to get in gear soon.
And if people want to connect with your work, how could they do that?
Well, I think the best place to I have my own site, just my last name, McLemy.com, which I have not really done very much with. You can find if you Google my name, you'll probably get the page at Inside Higher Ed that links all of my columns for there. And there's also a service that allows you to put up your clips or links to your clips. I think the address there is clips.me/mclemee. But the best bet is just to Google my name, and you'll find the people who absolutely hate me, and you'll find, you know, my list of stuff.
Excellent. That'd be entertaining both ways, right?
Yeah.
Scott, McLemee. That's his name.
Right. So I say there's no M in there. It's all M's.
Yes. Yes. And it's a pleasure having you on Troubadours and Rock on Tours. If you ever get to that book of essays and you're ready to talk about it, love to have you on again to talk about it.
I will take that. That's a motivation.
And if you have any closing thoughts to share with the listeners regarding, you know, whatever's on your mind, please.
Well, I'll tell you, the one thing that's on my mind today is, and I should have written something about this. Today is August 21st, 2020. Today is the 80th anniversary of the assassination of Leon Trotsky, who was a very significant historical figure from my own reading and research. And actually, as somebody said, one of the handful of people to make political writing into an art form. I think that anybody who has not done so, or is even maybe dubious about the idea that this is a figure you could find anything interesting about, I would strongly recommend Isaac Deutscher's trilogy of biographies, which I think by almost common consent is one of the great biographies of the political biographies in the English language. It's three volumes. It's The Prophet Armed, The Prophet Fallen, and The Prophet Outcast, something like that. And they're just they're a good 70 years old, I guess, but they're just or 60 years old at least. But they're just an amazingly good three-part biography.
Oh, excellent. Thank you for the suggestion. Assassinated somewhere, was it Mexico? Or
That was Stalin. That was Stalin. And actually, if you go back and you look at early stuff from 19 up through the rise of Stalin, up through Stalin assuming complete power, Lenin and Trotsky are names that are almost always paired. And that clearly, I mean, you don't want to reduce all of history to personal grievances and grudges, but that clearly was part of what Stalin was concerned to do, not just in assassinating him, but in doing everything possible to sort of obliterate his role in that history. A very mixed role, very complex role, but Stalin just reduced it all to a demonology. But Deutscher, Isaac Deutscher, just does an astounding job of covering all as much of that history as was available to him given the archives at the time.
Excellent.
It hasn't passed in the meantime, anyway.
I'm going to have to get my hands on it. I'm fascinated by Trotsky, too.
And you can get it on Kindle. So
excellent.
There's that.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us. And I think it's apropos that we ended on Trotsky and Stalin, given where we are in our own political scene.
Absolutely.
Well, enjoy the rest of your summer, and hopefully we cross paths again. Scott,
well, thank you very much. Thanks again for having me. This was a real pleasure.
Same here. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Leben sie zufrieden, denn du kein nur ein Minute mehr kein Rat. Mit Dachten, Trachten, Sorgen, Hustet deine Morgen, mit Fensterfell bei Schuck in zwei Banan. Was danken darf man noch, lernen trotzdem gut. Wollte diese Morgen sei dort gebrennt. Du sagst, sie bist da Bolschewik. Macht die faule Stück. Vier sollte jene Kimmen Herzen voll genommen. Russland ist in der Bolschewik. Russland ist in der Bolschewik. Und macht die faule Stück. Vier sollte jene Kimmen Herzen voll genommen. Russland ist in der Bolschewik. Mein Landsmann Arend Simmen, er stellt New York in Gimmen, kein Amerika im großen Land. Ich hätte nur sich nicht helfen, wie den Blick der noch helfen, die jetzt doch der die Arbeit nur erfangen. Apostel der Gebogen, die Furcht sich und die Scheuern, in die Arbeit nur es arbeiten mein Stich. Vom Wissen, wenn der Geld macht er ein Gewalt. Wollte mich in sich schicken, er fällt zurück. Im Moment, ich bin der Bolschewik und mach dich die volle Stich. Vier sollen jene Kimmen Herze voll genommen, Kimmen, die bis da Bolschewik. Kimmen, die bis da Bolschewik, und macht sie die volle Stück. Vier sollen jene Kimmen Herze voll genommen, Kimmen, die bis da Bolschewik.
The Lonesome Cowboy, Episode 3. I am the Lonesome Cowboy. I ride the lonely trails and eat my lonely meals beside a lonely campfire with only my faithful and sensitive pooch Petey for company. I don't get much mail on the trail. I have postal addresses here and there, and I occasionally pick up old summonses from my hog rustling days, or sad misspelled notes from old pals falling on hard times, begging for a small loan. So when I was last in town for a shave and a bath, and was presented with a citrus-smelling envelope by a crabby fellow behind the counter, I was surprised and delighted. The letter was from none other than Beatrice Flambeau, the lovely schoolmarm who stole my heart. That night my campfire was a little less lonesome. I finished my beans and my bitter coffee, had a pull of whiskey for dessert, and settled back to read B's letter. Dearest Lonesome Cowboy, I hope this letter finds you well. I pray you are taking care of yourself on that lonesome trail, eating right, men do not live on jerky alone, and are not drinking too much cheap whiskey. I can see you smiling. And indeed I was smiling. You're not doing any of those things, are you? Oh, you are a rascal. And indeed, I am a rascal. B's rascal. But you are my rascal, and I don't think you'll ever change. Here I sense the wistfulness in the tone of her missive. Well, it's been a busy time at the schoolhouse, but oh, how invigorating. Nothing can compare to seeing young minds blossom, learning to read and write, to enjoy poetry, to understand history, to be perplexed and intrigued and enlightened by science. Every day is an adventure in a way, like your life on the trail. Of course, I don't have to worry about rattlesnakes, just sleepy or chatty school children. But all has not been well in our little town. There was a cave-in at the mine not far from here, and two of my students, bright, curly-haired children whose eyes sparkled in delight during our lessons, these poor children lost their father in the accident. The town has been so supportive, and I'm doing my best to comfort them, but I'm afraid for their future of the fatherless children and their poor widowed mother. Ah, tender-hearted bee. Oh, let's leave sadness behind in this letter. I've been reading so much poetry lately, and even tried my hand at writing some. No, I won't send you a sample just yet. I have to improve my verse first. Oh, I sound like such a schoolmarm, don't I? I looked over at Petey and grinned. He grinned back at me. There is another event I should tell you about. The old editor of the newspaper moved back east to retire with his family, and a new editor, fresh from Boston, took his place. He's a bright young man, and not to be vain, I believe he's taken an interest in your bee. We've talked over tea, and we've discussed starting a literary society in our backwater. Imagine that. And he's asked me to submit poems to the paper. I groaned. A poetry-loving editor. We recite Wordsworth and Shakespeare together and chat about all manner of subjects. He's such a well-informed young man, and he's asked me to do To the Fall Dance. I tell you this, my dear lonesome cowboy, not to arouse your jealousy, but simply to give you a glance into my life without you as you ride the trails. Life must go on. And I must stop pining for you. You have your life, and I have mine. Perhaps some day they'll intertwine. Ah, a rhyme. Be well, dearest. Ever yours, be. I heard Petey stifle a sob, and I did likewise. Oh, my bee. My dearest bee. I folded the letter carefully and stared into the campfire. I am a lonely cowboy.
I hear the train a-comin', it's rollin' around the bend, and And I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But that train keeps rolling on down to San Antone. When I was just a baby, my mama told me, son, always be a good boy, don't ever play with guns. But I shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. When I hear that whistle blowing, I hang my head and cry. I bet there's rich folks eating in a fancy dining car. They're probably drinking coffee and smoking big cigars. Well, I know I had it coming. I know I can't be free. But those people keep a moving, and that's what tortures me. Railroad train was mine, I bet I'd move it on a little farther down the line, far from Folsom Prison. That's where I want to stay. And I'd let that lonesome whistle blow my blues away.
Trusty couch. I've got a busted finger, and my van is leaking antifreeze. This pandemic has me nervous about every cough and sneeze. School is set to start with empty classrooms. The openness of theaters and stadiums quietly looms. Presidential speeches and major league home runs happen with no one there. I watch and listen, sitting on this trusty old couch, with a steady sort of despair.
A girl went back to Napoli because she missed the scenery, the native dances and the charming songs. But wait a minute, something's wrong. Hey mambo, mambo Italiano. Hey mambo, mambo Italiano. Go, go, go. You mixed up Siciliano. All you Calabrese do the mambo like a crazy with a hey mambo. Don't want a tarantella. Hey mambo, no more mozzarella. Hey mambo, mambo Italiano. Try an enchilada with the fish baccalà. And hey gumba, I love how you dance a rumba. But take some of advice, paisano. Learn how to mambo. If you're gonna be a square, you ain't gonna go nowhere. Hey mambo, mambo Italiano. Hey mambo, mambo Italiano. Go, go, Joe. Shake like a Giovanni. Hey, look, as a deed, you get a happy in the feet. So when you mambo Italiano. Shake a baby, shake it, cause I love it when you take a me.
vino, it's like a vino. Kid, you're good at looking, but you don't know it's cooking till you.
Hey, mambo,
mambo Italiano.
Hey, mambo,
mambo Italiano.
Ho, ho, ho.
You mixed up Siciliana, it's so delicious. Everybody come capisce how to mambo Italiano. Nice.
And there you have it, episode 384 of Troubadours and Raconteurs, with yours truly, E.W. Conundrum Demure. I'd like to thank those folks who made this episode possible. First and foremost, Scott McLemy, our associate producer, Dr. Michael Pavese, actor Dominic Azzarelli, and these musical artists: Django Reinhardt, Stefan Grappelli, Spoon, Willie Nelson, Morris Goldstein, Johnny Cash, Rosemary Clooney, and of course Branford Marsalis and Terrence Blanchard too. And I'd like to thank you for listening. Until next time, let's give it a go and do our best with this time. Take care.